Have you ever wondered how artificial intelligence is helping solve medical problems? Or how medical research is making it easier to predict your genetic risks for disease? Hi, I'm Kathy Werzer. Tomorrow's Cure, a podcast from Mayo Clinic and PRX, is back for Season 2. Join me as I interview experts who are shaping the future of healthcare with groundbreaking advancements. What they describe may sound futuristic, but listen and you'll find out. Tomorrow's Cure is already here. Find it now wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Health Matters, a podcast from Mayo Clinic where we discuss the latest medical advice, news, and research to help you live a happier and healthier life. My name is Kristen Meinzer. I'm a writer and journalist. And this episode, we're revisiting fertility care for a part two. In the last episode, we covered the basics: what infertility is, the reasons a patient or a couple may be struggling with their fertility, and what the process of diagnosis looks like. This episode, we're going to talk about the many available options for treatment. Welcome back to our guest, Dr. Zarat Khan, a gynecologist and reproductive endocrinologist at Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota. Last year, he released the second edition of his book, Mayo Clinic Guide to Fertility and Conception. Dr. Khan, what are the fertility treatment options available for patients who've been struggling to get pregnant?
It's a loaded question because it really depends on what issues are going on with the patients, right? So if it's sperm issues primarily, sperm issues can be addressed with two major ways. One is intrauterine insemination, IUI, where we take the sperm, we spin it down, we get like the best swimmers out of the sperm, and then we inject that sperm inside of the uterus, much like a pap smear is done around the time of ovulation. So that's intrauterine insemination. There's several different reasons why we do that. The most common one is if there's numbers issue or a motility or a forward progression swimming issue in the sperm. Of course, if there's very little sperm, then we have to resort to what we call advanced ART or advanced assisted reproductive techniques, primarily in form of IVF or in vitro fertilization. Now, IVF, it's a technical name. In vitro means outside of the body. Fertilization meaning the egg meeting the sperm. So it's basically IVF is a verb. It's creating embryos outside of the body. But in order to get to that, we have to do the entire process of getting medications on board on the female part to create lots of eggs in that cohort, getting eggs from the female, preparing them in the lab, getting sperm from the partner, getting the eggs with the sperm, creating the embryos, culturing the embryos to day five, which we want a specific time where we want to transfer the embryo back to the uterus, and then transferring the embryo back to the uterus. So IVF, even though it's a verb, it's a one-word thing where the egg meeting the sperm outside of the body, the whole process is what we refer to when we say IVF.
What about ICSI or ICSI?
It's an acronym and it stands for intracytoplasmic sperm injection. Cytoplasm is basically the material in a cell or in the egg. So that's where rather than doing standard insemination, which is to put the eggs and the sperm together in the petri dish to make embryos, we're actually physically taking the sperm and injecting it into each egg to make the embryo. Many reasons for that too, but that's when the sperm quality is very, very poor. The numbers are very low.
So those are treatment options for male factor infertility. What about treatments for female factor infertility?
Very similar for the female factor. It just depends. So if there's issues with the fallopian tube and the fallopian tubes are blocked completely, sometimes we can try to open them surgically. Mostly we are unable to. So if the fallopian tubes are blocked, we need IVF anyway because that's a physical blockage. So we need to get eggs out to create embryos to put embryo back into the uterus. If it's an egg issue, which means that the egg reserves are low, we can sometimes do oral medications to create more eggs. The body makes one egg at a time. With oral medications, we can try to make 2 to 3 eggs at a time. But if the egg numbers are even lower, that's when we pull out the big guns, the IVF out, when we give you injectable medications to create all the eggs that the body has recruited for that month, 9 to 25 or something like that. And then we're taking those eggs out of the body, combining them with sperm to create embryos to do embryo transfer. So there's several variations. It just depends on what the primary pathology is.
And how does that process work? So female patient gets injected, is it daily or weekly? How often is she being injected to get those eggs ready? And how long does it take to get those eggs ready to be harvested?
For an IVF cycle, it's somewhere between 10 to 12 days, 10 to 14 days. We say about 2 weeks. So we have to take control over the menstrual cycle. So we put patients on birth control for about a week or two. So that sort of sinks them and stops the communication between the brain and the ovary, because we want to start talking to the ovary, not the signals from the brain. So we start them on birth control, then we stop, we have a withdrawal bleed, and then we start the medications. When we start the medications, they're daily injections, about 2 or 3 daily injections for about 10 to 14 days. And during that time is when we get patients back into the clinic to do blood work and to do ultrasounds to see how they're responding to those shots. Typically, it's on even days. So skip day 2, but day 4, day 6, day 8 is when patients come in for some form of evaluation. Depending on what we see on day 8, we may bring them back 1 or 2 more times before the eggs are ready. When the eggs are ready, then we instruct patients to give themselves a particular shot to release the eggs. We call it the trigger shot or the egg release shot. Eggs get released in about 42, 50 hours. We go in at 36 hours to get the eggs before they get released from the ovary. So typically the way it works is you take a shot in the evening, and if you take a shot at 8 p.m. on a Monday night, we are trying to retrieve you at 8 a.m. on a Wednesday morning.
Sounds like an involved process. Lots of injections, lots of examinations, lots of blood tests and so on that go into it. But it's only for a couple of weeks.
Correct. It's about 10 to 14 days, I would say. And it is. I mean, there's about 2 shots a day. I usually tell people that there's a lot more sort of press and conversations around how difficult it is. Mm-hmm. And it's our job to sort of talk patients through that. And sometimes patients want to do surgery or fertility treatment, and maybe fertility treatment is the right option for them. But I tell them fertility treatment and an IVF cycle is probably way easier than an actual surgery. And so we try to make sure that we can bust those myths of how involved an IVF cycle is, but it still is a commitment for about 2 weeks. Mm-hmm.
And is there an average of how many IVF cycles a couple might go through before they actually conceive?
It really, really, really depends on the reason for infertility. So if somebody has diminished ovarian reserve or very low egg counts, it wouldn't be uncommon for them to do several cycles, 2, 3, even sometimes 4 cycles, and to really even be able to get that exposure of embryo transfers. So remember, success is then a different story. When people do IVF, the common misconception is, of course, we're going to get pregnant because we spent $25,000 on this. That's far from the truth. IVF success rates are not 100%. It's a very sort of loaded question because it depends on the scenario that the patient comes in and what sort of issues they're facing.
When children have anxiety disorders or OCD, they may feel anxious or upset, even when there's nothing happening around them that would frighten or bother most other kids. And as parents, we're all just looking to help our kids through whatever they're experiencing. If you're a parent to a kiddo with anxiety or OCD, pick up a copy of Anxiety Coach, published by Mayo Clinic Press. In it, clinical psychologist Dr. Stephen Whiteside shares practical skills, tools, and guidelines to help parents carry out exposure therapy with their child at home. Start your family's journey toward anxiety-free living today. Get your copy of Anxiety Coach at mcpress.mayoclinic.org and use code KIDS for 10% off your order today.
When it comes to fertility treatments, there are plenty of different options, and which ones you use can depend on the source of the infertility. For male factor infertility, there are a few choices, including IUI, or intrauterine insemination, which can help if there's an issue with the number of sperm or the sperm's motility. for very low sperm count, there's also the option of advanced ART, aka advanced assisted reproductive techniques. One of those is in vitro fertilization, or IVF, which basically means creating embryos outside the body. There's also ICSI, or intracytoplasmic sperm injection, taking the sperm to inject it into each egg to make an embryo. This is particularly useful when the sperm quality and sperm numbers are low. When it comes to female factor infertility, there may be a number of different causes, starting with blocked fallopian tubes, which can be opened surgically and may need IVF. If the egg reserves are low, there can be oral medications to create more eggs. And if the numbers are especially low, then there are also injectable medications with IVF to increase the number of eggs. Now, IVF can be a very involved process, but it's also a short one, lasting from 10 to 14 days. At the same time, it's important to keep in mind that any patient undergoing IVF may have to undergo several cycles. Next, let's go over other treatment options and the myth of cryopreservation. So we've talked about IVF, which is essentially harvesting eggs, combining them with sperm, making an embryo, putting that into a woman's body so that it can gestate there. But there's this other thing called gestational surrogacy. How is that different?
That's a great question. And that sort of comes into what we call third-party reproduction. Third-party reproduction is a term used when couples need gametes from a third source. So if we see a couple that has significantly diminished ovarian reserve or major egg problems, they may recruit a donor, an anonymous donor, or even a known donor to donate eggs to them. They can buy frozen eggs from anonymous donor banks, or we don't really actually even call it anonymous anymore. They're called non-directed, because after 23andMe and all kinds of different things that we have, so you can pretty much find out sources if you really want to. And of the same matter now, there are agencies that even you can adopt embryos. So if a couple has both male and female factor issues, rather than getting donor egg and donor sperm, they can just get donated or donor embryos to be transplanted back to the uterus at an appropriate time, one at a time. So that's what sort of the world of third party is. And within that, there are circumstances when the patient has no uterus, so you're either born without a uterus, or one uses a uterus at a very young age from cancer or catastrophic obstetrical hemorrhage around deliveries, or when the uterus is non-functional. So if there's scar tissue in the uterus, if there's extensive fibroids or disease in the uterus that otherwise can't be surgically corrected short of a hysterectomy, those are the circumstances when our couples and patients can use what's called a gestational carrier. In lay language, it's called a surrogate, but a surrogate technically is illegal because a surrogate is a person that provides the egg and the uterus and technically makes that person the genetic mother. So just sort of splitting hairs here, but really it's a gestational carrier, or it's called a gestational carrier surrogate, where we utilize somebody else's uterus to carry an embryo or a pregnancy. And most of the times, couples that create an embryo but are unable to transfer that to the uterus will use a gestational carrier to carry that pregnancy for them.
When it comes to eggs themselves, a lot of people nowadays, a lot of women in particular, are being told, just freeze your eggs and don't worry about it, and you can use them in the future, because we live in a society now where it can be very difficult to get your career on track, get financially stable, afford a house, find a partner, and do all of that when the biological clock is ticking. And yet, I have to say, I come across articles year after year after year saying, you know what? Maybe that's not the promise everyone thinks it is.
That's very smart that we're talking about it, and really important that we're talking about it too, because I think the messaging that patients are receiving is, I've got eggs and I'm good. I'm guaranteed a family, right? And unfortunately, that's far from the truth, because there are several different points when it comes to that. The first one is, remember when we freeze eggs, we have a false number in mind. So when I tell people, if you have $5,000 in your bank account, you can buy things worth $5,000. If you have 6 eggs in the bank, that does not mean you will have 6 children. That is far from that. What that means is you have 6 eggs in cryopreserved state, and in the future, you have the ability to still utilize these 6 eggs towards creating embryos that then may or may not result in a pregnancy in the future. That depends on several different characteristics and several different factors. Number one, when we freeze eggs, the number that we have in mind is always a false number because we always lose eggs when we thaw them. So for every 6 eggs frozen, when we thaw them, we may get 4 or 5 that survive the process, which is much different from embryos, because if we freeze 6 embryos, we probably will get all 6 that survive the thaw process, right? And so those are the difference between egg and embryo freezing. And that's why if a person is doing something like fertility preservation and has a partner that they're committed to, and that's a long-term partner that they want to start a family with, my recommendation is always to freeze embryos over eggs because of this very reason. So the math that we do is for every 6 frozen eggs, we're expecting only 1 or 2 embryos to be made that would be able to be transferred to the uterus. Each embryo would probably have about a 48 to 54% success rate if the patient is in the ideal age group of under 35. So that is what we mean by success of freezing eggs.
What other factors affect the viability of frozen eggs leading to a pregnancy?
It also is dependent on what age you freeze the eggs. It is dependent on if your partner has sperm issues or not. It depends on also what age you're going to transfer these embryos back. So for example, past age 50, we don't recommend transferring embryos to the uterus because we know that there's uterine aging as well that can cause issues with success rates, right? We also know that every pregnancy has a 15% miscarriage rate. And so when you talk about take-home baby rate and numbers from each egg frozen, you need a lot more eggs in the bank to have one successful live birth. And I think it's those numbers that are misleading our patients when we do counseling. And it is upon us, the fertility providers, to really give the patient a good idea of what that really means, right? And it really is important for the patient to understand that everything we do is an inverted pyramid where we start with higher numbers, but as we move on to more progressive states to write that holy grail of take-home baby rate, numbers tend to dwindle and drop down at every step. And this is why egg freezing is important, and it's a really good step and proactive step to make because you're reducing your chances of being in a position where you won't be able to start a family. You're just reducing that risk. You're never guaranteeing anybody that you will be pregnant if you freeze eggs.
Thank you for all the clarification there because, as I said, the messaging tends to be way more optimistic than the reality. I wonder what the real numbers are when it comes to how many people freeze their eggs and then actually go on to use them.
We have European studies that show that only about 20 to 24% of patients actually utilize their frozen gametes, which is very alarming to me. And I think it all goes back to us being human beings and inherent human nature, right? It's basically people hold on to frozen gametes as insurance and as hope. And they try to do everything else before and are very, very hesitant to thaw their gametes because then they feel like this is it. And if it doesn't work, I don't have anything to back up on, right? And people get very nervous. It's like liquidating your bank balance and liquidating your cash assets, essentially.
Fascinating. It says a lot about human nature and our human psyches, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
At some point during fertility treatment, a patient may seek third-party reproduction, where they source gametes, meaning the eggs and sperm, from a third source. This can mean buying frozen eggs from a recruited donor or donor bank, or it can even mean adopting an embryo. There are also circumstances when a couple or a patient can use a gestational carrier, basically utilizing a third party's uterus to carry the embryo to pregnancy. Now, an entirely different option for fertility treatments involves cryopreservation. And while patients can freeze their eggs, sperm, or even embryos, it's important to remember that doing so is never a guarantee of a future pregnancy. Only some of a patient's frozen eggs or embryos may survive the thawing process. And then there's also other factors, like the female patient's age or whether or not the partner's sperm has any issues. There's always risk in every fertility method, but the good news is there are still more options, including new and experimental procedures. Now, let's talk about newer and possibly more experimental procedures. For example, ovary or uterine transplants. Can you tell me how those work?
Yeah, absolutely. So let's take ovary first, because I think that's a little bit easier to wrap your brain around, and then we'll go to the uterus as well. So we call it ovarian tissue transplant because think of the human ovary as a hard-boiled chicken egg, no pun intended here. But think of the human ovary as a hard-boiled chicken egg where all the fertility potential lies in the egg shell. The egg white and the egg yolk is just there for support of hormones. So when we talk about all the primordial or the resting eggs that a woman is born with, they lie on the outermost covering or outermost area of the ovary. The goal of ovarian tissue freezing is that if we are at a scenario where there is an imminent threat to fertility, meaning somebody got diagnosed with cancer and they need to start chemotherapy tonight or tomorrow because their health is at jeopardy, how do we save their fertility? How do we protect their fertility? Because we don't have 2 weeks to get eggs from them and do IVF and freeze embryos or freeze eggs. They're starting chemotherapy tomorrow. And we know when they start chemotherapy, that's going to be a detriment to their ovarian function. That's when this role of ovarian tissue freezing comes in. Mm. Also, in people that have not started their periods, in pediatric population, and the brain has not yet communicated with the ovary, we cannot stimulate the ovary. So in kids, ovarian tissue freezing is the only way to preserve their fertility thus far. And so there, the concept is that before chemotherapy starts, we do a laparoscopy and remove a whole ovary, or a part of one ovary, and we take these cortical strips, which is the outermost layer of the ovary, we remove that and we freeze that in hopes of transplanting it back to the patient in the future when they're in remission. This is a science that started in the early 2000s and now is routinely done. And this is another means of fertility preservation. So it's what we call in the medical world autologous transplant, meaning your own tissue is being transplanted back to your body. Now, the advantage of this is you don't need to be on all the medications, the anti-rejection medications that people take after a transplant, because it's part of your own body. It has also been studied in identical twins, and identical twins also don't need to take rejection medications because they're considered autologous pretty much. So once these patients are in then remission, we take the ovarian tissue, we transplant it back to the abdomen, and that regains function. In Europe, we do this not only for fertility, but we also do this for induction of puberty. So to start puberty process and also for hormone replacement in postmenopausal women, if they have ovarian tissue left, we can prolong the reproductive age cycle by delaying that menopause part of it. So that's with the ovarian transplant.
Fascinating. Do people ever use outside donors? You mentioned identical twins, but could I have a donor, for example, who is just somebody I'm completely not related to?
So we feel like the medical risk associated with that is much higher. Why wouldn't we just use the egg from another person? Because going on anti-rejection medications is also a huge risk for patients. So In that scenario, ethically, it is not being studied because if patients need eggs and hormones, the ovary has two functions, right? Fertility and hormones. We can definitely provide hormone replacement very safely with medications. So that's one part of the ovary being restored. The other part of ovarian function that's being lost is fertility. And in that scenario, we use donor eggs, where we still don't need to use anti-rejection medications. So taking ovarian tissue from one person and putting it back to another person is not being studied. because for that, you do need to take anti-rejection medications. And the risk of that is very high. And we have easy, very safe workaround processes around that. Now, the uterus is a separate story. Uterus transplantation was pioneered by Mats Brunström in Sweden. And really, that is when women have what we call absolute uterine factor infertility, meaning that they don't have a uterus. They were either born without a uterus, or they lost a uterus to early cancer, obstetrical hemorrhage, or some other reason where a hysterectomy is performed. Now, that's a scenario where we use a donor uterus from either a deceased donor or a live donor, and a uterus transplant is done to that patient. Now, it's a temporary transplant. We call it ephemeral transplant, which is a transplant that is done for up to 5 years or 2 live births. These patients also create embryos before because they still have ovaries. They just don't have a uterus. The goal of this is to carry a biologic child. So they have to have embryos cryopreserved from beforehand. And then we use a donor uterus. It's a fairly extensive surgical procedure. We then do a uterus transplant. These patients go on anti-rejection medications. Once, you know, a few months have passed and the uterus has not been rejected, then that's when we start the embryo transfer processes. And right now, like I said, it's temporary. Once we achieve those goals, that donor uterus is then removed and the patients go off of the anti-rejection medications.
Oh my gosh. Science does amazing things.
Absolutely. It's a fascinating thing.
Very fascinating. Are there any other big new technologies that we should know about when it comes to reproduction right now?
You know, there's a lot of work going on in our field, which makes it so fascinating. There's lots of work on how do we improve quality of gametes, egg and sperm? How do we improve culture conditions for embryos so that we can get more embryos to what we call day 5 stage or the blastocyst stage where we actually do embryo transfers? And of course, there's a lot more emphasis being put on how do we work with the biggest thing that fertility doctors see in the clinic, diminished ovarian reserve and the impact of aging on the quality of the egg. And we know that with aging eggs, a lot of the issues come from the mitochondria. Mitochondria are little organelles in cells that breathe for the cell, or what we call the powerhouses or the factory that keeps the cell alive. And there's some work now being done to say, what if we remove the nucleus of the cell that carries the DNA, which will give identity to the children, and we took the nucleus from an older egg and put it in a newer egg. So almost do a nuclear transplant of the egg, meaning that we would give the DNA a new housing almost, or a younger housing. There's a lot of work being now done on what we call in vitro activation, meaning that when we get immature eggs out of the ovary, making them mature outside of the body in the lab so that we can make embryos out of them and then transfer those embryos to create pregnancies. So lots more in the pipeline and newer projects coming in every day that will have a common goal of giving more efficiency to the reproductive system and in turn translating that into higher success rates for our patients.
Oh, that's excellent. And are there any special technologies for trans patients who might want biological children?
Yeah, that's a great question too. So for our trans patients, you know, one of the things that we talk about is depending on how open our patients are to carrying the pregnancies or not. So for our trans patients or individuals that are born with ovaries, our trans male population may or may not want to carry that pregnancy, may or may not want to go through a stimulation and get eggs frozen. So usually for our trans patients, we end up freezing ovarian tissue at the time of gender affirmation surgery when they're going through a hysterectomy and oophorectomy. That's the easiest way to get that ovarian tissue and freeze it for the future. But like I mentioned to you earlier, right now we're limited to taking that tissue and putting it back into the same person's body. And our trans man is not going to want that ovarian tissue back in their body because they've already gone through gender affirmation procedure. And so the question now is, how do we best utilize that ovarian tissue from our trans male populations without transferring it back to their body? And this is where we enter sort of like the twilight zone, right? Because I talk to people about some thoughts of creating mouse models or mouse avatars where we could potentially take that ovarian tissue, transplant it to a nude mouse, stimulate the mouse and get eggs generating in the mouse, get eggs from that mouse, combine them with sperm to create embryos, And that's sort of where a lot of like work is being done on, can we create other animal models where we can harvest and develop this ovarian tissue to make eggs? And then if that trans male patient is with a cisgender female, transferred back to their uterus or transferred back to a gestational carrier if they're with a cis male, for example. And so there's several different variations that one could use, but it's that gap of getting that ovarian tissue to get to develop eggs outside of our trans male patient's body.
It'll be fascinating to see where the technology goes in the coming years and decades.
Absolutely.
Now, I'd be remiss to not bring up some barriers here. All of these technologies, they come with a price tag, they come with accessibility issues, they come with, you know, the luxury of having enough time off to even do all of this. Can we talk about some of the things that are necessary to even pursue some of these options?
Yeah, and I think that's really a very important part that also is not to be missed, right? One of the biggest hurdle and burden for patients is access to fertility care and access to reproductive endocrinologists, and then also coverage for these services. There's only 17 states right now that mandate fertility coverage. The WHO defines infertility as a disease, yet we don't have universal coverage when it comes to third-party payers for fertility. We don't have Medicaid, Medicare coverage in states where it's not mandated. We don't have fertility preservation coverages. These are patients that have absolutely no choice but to preserve their fertility because they're faced with a cancer diagnosis. As far as the time commitment is concerned, of course, this is not a walk in the park. IVF is about 2 weeks of extensive monitoring with at least 3 to 4 visits to the clinic, ultrasounds, blood work, and our patients are busy. And that's where we start talking about sort of innovative strategies that we are currently also involved in. I think the pandemic sort of pushed us really forward to rethink about how we can deliver healthcare and also how we can specifically deliver healthcare like fertility healthcare to patients where we don't even need to examine. We can look at blood tests and just counsel patients. So telehealth, having to make sure that patients don't come into the clinic. And as much as the offerings that we do in the clinic, trying to get that to the comfort of the patient's home, I think will also be on the horizon very soon. And I know that several groups, including us at Mayo, are really heavily invested and involved with that as we see that to be the future of healthcare delivery, especially in reproductive medicine. So I think that is the biggest hurdle and barrier for our patients is the financial aspect of it and the access to reproductive endocrinologists.
Any final words of optimism for any listeners out there who might be having a difficult time getting pregnant or who've been diagnosed with a condition that might impact their fertility?
Absolutely. I think it's really important to understand the biggest thing I tell my couples and patients is you're not alone. Okay. I think it's really important when one is facing infertility and one is facing these challenges, oftentimes people feel like they're on an isolated island and they're all by themselves and they're scared. Fertility or infertility issues are on the rise. When I was in training, it was 1 in 10 couples, then 1 in 8. So you're not alone. Number two, unfortunately, society still thinks of fertility conversations as taboo. This is very natural. This is not taboo. People may not talk about it, but your best friend might be suffering from something that you have no idea. So being mindful of that, and also being mindful of the conversations we have in front of people that may be dealing with this is really, really important. And the third thing is that science has come a very, very long way since the first IVF baby was born in the 70s, right? Our success rates are improving. This is not sort of Twilight Zone medicine anymore. This is routine medicine. And a latest study would show that 2.5% of all births in the United States are from IVF. So this is something that is very, very common. And I always tell people there should be no shame or taboo associated with this. You want a family? There's many, many ways of building families, be it adoption, be it IVF, be it the au naturel way. So really removing these stigmas and having more open conversations and also talking about increasing successes and this becoming more routine and not sort of rocket science medicine are a few things that I really talk to patients about. Because I say, you know, we're in this situation, we have lemons, but we're going to make delicious lemonade and enjoy it at the same time.
Dr. Khan, thank you so much for all the information and for all the hope that you're leaving us with today. We really appreciate the conversation.
Thank you so much. And it was really a privilege and an honor to talk to you, guys.
When it comes to new techniques in fertility treatment, one option is ovarian tissue transplant. This is for a situation where there's an imminent threat to fertility, when someone is diagnosed with cancer and needs to start chemotherapy immediately, for example, or if a trans patient is getting gender affirmation surgery. Doctors can remove the outermost layer of the ovary and then freeze it in hopes of transplanting it back to the patient in the future. This is called autologous transplant. Then there's uterus transplantation for patients born without a uterus or for those who have lost one. It's a temporary transplant with the ultimate goal of allowing the patient to carry a biological child and can last up to 5 years or two live births. There are even more ongoing developments in fertility care, from improving the quality of gametes to working on reducing the impact of aging on the quality of eggs. Doctors are even employing mouse models to harvest and develop ovarian tissue. But even as fertility science continues to come up with amazing strides in the field, it's important to note that ongoing barriers to fertility care continue to exist, including barriers to access, coverage, and also time. Okay, that's all for this episode. But if you've got a question or topic suggestion, you can leave us a voicemail at 507-538-6272. We might even feature your voice on the show. And for more information on Dr. Khan's book, Mayo Clinic Guide to Fertility and Conception, check out our show notes online. For more Health Matters episodes and resources, head to mayoclinic.org/healthmatters. And if you found this show helpful, please subscribe and make sure to rate and review us in your podcast app. It really does help others find the show. Thanks for listening. And until next time, take care and stay healthy.
Have you ever wondered how artificial intelligence is helping solve medical problems? Or how medical research is making it easier to predict your genetic risks for disease? Hi, I'm Kathy Werzer. Tomorrow's Cure, a podcast from Mayo Clinic and PRX, is back for season two. Join me as I interview experts who are shaping the future of healthcare with groundbreaking advancements. What they describe may sound futuristic, but listen and you'll find out. Tomorrow's Cure is already here. Find it now wherever you get your podcasts.
This podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon as medical or legal advice. Always consult with a qualified healthcare provider for any medical questions. The appearance of any guest does not imply an endorsement of them, their employer, or any entity they represent. The views and opinions are those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect the views of Mayo Clinic. Reference to any product, service, or entity does not constitute an endorsement of or recommendation by Mayo Clinic.